showed you a blurry picture of what looked like a big-headed frog. "Your baby is very smart," he would say to me and my husband, Will Arnett. "You are doing everything right. Please, drink one or two glasses of wine at night." I was so lucky to have Dr. G as my doctor. I didn't feel neurotic or stressed. I felt like a success. I ate what I wanted, and I felt super sexy. I was lucid enough to realize that I was on a total hormonal high and that a crash was just around the corner, but I didn't care. I loved being pregnant. I loved being at work and still feeling vital and busy while this extraordinary thing was happening inside of me. I never felt alone. I always had a companion. I reveled in all the new space I was taking up. When your stomach is big, you knock things over and everyone stays out of your way. I was big in brand new ways and I felt very powerful and womanly. I couldn't have chosen a better doctor to deliver my first child. Unfortunately, that never happened. Dr. G died the day before I went into labor. Yep. But before I get to that, the last week of SNL, before my son Archie arrived, was incredibly exciting. The 2008 presidential race was almost a dead heat, and the entire year leading up to the election had been a magical time to work on a live, satirical sketch comedy show. Everything felt electric. The audience knew the ins and outs of every political story, and a lot of it had to do with what Saturday Night Live was doing. I think everyone was crushing it that season, and the show had never been better. We could barely keep up with the daily goodies and produced 4 primetime Weekend Update Thursday specials during September and October. I was 8 months pregnant and did 15 live shows in 13 weeks. Everyone came on. I met then-presidential candidate Barack Obama while I was dressed as Dennis Kucinich. Maya was dressed as Barack Obama at the time, so the introduction might have been slightly more embarrassing for her. We were doing a sketch about how hot Kucinich's wife was. That's how much America was paying attention. Then Tina played Sarah Palin for the first time and blew the roof off the joint. The anticipation of Tina playing Palin was so fun to witness, and she explains it well in her book, 50 Shades of Grey. She totally took on what was expected of her, and it was awesome to stand next to her as she killed. The sketch that night dealt with Hillary Clinton coming to terms with Vice Presidential Candidate Sarah Palin. It dealt with fierce competitiveness in politics. It dealt with power and entitlement. It dealt with the way society forces women to define themselves and compete against each other. It tackled old theories about Madonna versus whore and slut versus shrew. But most importantly, it was really funny. That sketch was written by Seth Meyers. Tina and I added jokes. SNL, and now Late Show with Seth Meyers producer Mike Shoemaker, wrote the legendary line, "I can see Russia from my house." I remember standing on stage and it being one of the few times that something felt perfectly whole. Archie did flips in my stomach each time the audience clapped. It was the closest to what I imagine it feels like to write a hit song. My stomach grew bigger and the election grew closer. With just a few weeks left, Governor Sarah Palin was asked to come on the show. I'd never met her, but many years before, I had met Senator John McCain when he hosted and liked him instantly. We did a scene in a shower together, and he was totally appropriate while also being very pleased. He was vigorous and honest. He noticed me smoking and told me if he knew the world was going to end, the first thing he would do is start smoking again. He invited me to his house in Arizona. We hit it off. I knew Tina would do a great opening sketch with Sarah Palin, and Seth and I were trying to think of something to do with her at the update desk. I think I made some sort of joke about getting her to do a hardcore rap or something. Then I laughed at the thought of doing one right near her in the gigantic state that I was in. Seth laughed too. I mean, it certainly wasn't some wildly original idea, but as usual at SNL, the time pressure lets us do things without overthinking. When you're pregnant, you can get away with a lot of shit. Women really are their most dangerous during this time. Your hormones are telling you that you're strong and sexy, everyone's scared of you, and you have a built-in sidekick who might come out at any minute. There should be some kind of pregnancy superhero movie. Calling Hollywood now. What's that, Hollywood? It's a weird idea, and also you don't do movies with female superheroes? Okay, copy that. I went into my dressing room and wrote the rap. Seth helped. Andy Samberg helped. I met Palin in her dressing room beforehand to go over things, and I was honestly surprised that they didn't make us change more of it. She and her team only wanted to modify a small joke about Todd being a real ladies' man or something, I think. Her daughter, Bristol, was pregnant at the time, and we made small talk about babies. I did the rap, and it was super fun. My stomach looked so big, it almost seemed fake. It was ridiculous. I was so tired between dress and air that I remember lying in my dressing room like a bear and sleeping deeply in between sketches. Which brings us to Friday, October 24th, 2008, the day I went into labor, the day after my doctor died. The musical guest that week was Coldplay, and it was going to be John Hamm's first time hosting the show. I'd been working the whole time and feeling pretty good, exhausted, yes, but invigorated. And honestly, at the end of a pregnancy, any lady will tell you she's searching for anything to take her mind off the creature that is about to burst forth. So I had done my rap the previous Saturday and slept all day Sunday feeling happy. Will and I had our suitcases packed and a name picked out. We were both so happy and so in love. Nothing brings a couple closer than a baby about to arrive. Each person needs the other so desperately and in such new and deep ways. Each day through the week, I was doing my check-in with the doctor. As we all know, a watched cervix never dilates, and I'd still been tight and sassy that Thursday morning. Dr. G assured me that I would probably deliver a few days late, like most new mothers. I told him I was going to do the show on Saturday, even though it was technically my due date, but any time after that would be fine. It was the first of many times I ridiculously thought I had any control over my schedule, this baby, or life and death in general. I was in the middle of rehearsing a Mad Men parody Friday morning and called to confirm my 3 p.m. appointment. The receptionist answered the phone crying. She told me Dr. G had passed away from a heart attack in his sleep. I burst into tears so loudly and violently that I think water was squirting out of my eyes, like in a Kathy cartoon. Nothing is more horrifying than a giant pregnant lady sobbing. Everyone got very quiet. I hung up the phone and I told John and the hair and makeup people that my doctor had just died. And I was due tomorrow. And that I knew it seemed like a weird punchline, but my beloved and dear Italian grandpa was not going to be able to help me. I felt so terrible about the fact that all I was thinking was, what about me? I cried and cried in my Mad Men dress. John Hamm held me by the shoulders and looked at me and said, I know this is very sad. But this is a really important show for me, so I'm going to need you to get your shit together. This made me laugh so hard, I think I peed. Going from crying to laughing that fast and hard happens maybe 5 times in your life, and that extreme right turn is the reason why we are alive. And I believe it extends our life by many years. I told everyone at dress rehearsal. It freaked them out. At 3 p.m., I went to Dr. G's office and was met by his grieving colleagues who had worked with him for decades. One of them, the lovely Dr. B, examined me and told me I shouldn't worry. Nothing was happening and I would probably deliver a few days late. He had already treated and met with Dr. G's other patients and would spend the next 24 hours delivering 5 babies. He was kind and professional, but it was extremely weird. He was a stranger. I went back to SNL, where I stayed until 2 a.m. Maya and Fred Armisen were doing bits on the main stage, pretending to be robot versions of themselves. And I laughed, and I laughed, and for the millionth time, I thought about how lucky I was. Eddie, the security guard, walked me to my car and asked me how I was doing. I'm tired, I said. I went home and got into bed. It was 3:30 in the morning. I put on my favorite TV show, Law & Order, to go to sleep. I heard the bum-bum sound effect in the opening credits, and my water broke. Do you know when your water breaks, the best thing to do is stand up? Your baby acts like a plug. Isn't that insane? Strange thoughts like this and others filled my head as Will and I tenderly got ready to go to the hospital. I had that nervy feeling you get when you know your whole life is going to change and you realize you're made of tissue paper at the same time. Will raced around and I weirdly brushed my teeth. And as we got our car from the garage, our doorman predicted we were going to have a girl. I sat down in Will's car and gushed all over it. I was worried that he would be upset, but he laughed as he helped me in. I looked at him and I thought, I've turned into an animal now, and I have a feeling this will be the nicest thing you see all night. I took drugs and pushed. It was hard and long. I texted Shoemaker and Seth and told them I wouldn't be coming to work. While I tried to get my little bugger out, SNL scrambled to replace my parts. The real Elizabeth Moss came in to play herself, and she met Fred Armisen, who 1 year later, to the day, would become her husband. I would go to their wedding on my one-year-old boy Archie's birthday. Seth Meyers prepared to do Update alone for the first time. He would go on to do it alone successfully for years, although I like to think it was a tiny bit less fun. My big-headed wonder couldn't get out, and I started thinking crazy thoughts. What if this was the one baby they couldn't get out? What if they just handed me back my clothes and sent me home and said, "We are so sorry. We did what we could, but we just couldn't get him out. We wish you the best." I felt like the bouncer of my own uterus. I was ready to turn on all the lights and kick that baby out. Time to wrap it up. I don't care where you go, but you can't stay here. I finally had a C-section. As I was wheeled into the operating room, one of the nurses said, "Hey, it's Hillary Clinton," and I answered by barfing all over her. Full circle. Archie was born Saturday, October 25th at 6:09 p.m., just about when we would have been getting ready to do our first run-through for Weekend Update. He was, and remains, perfect. My whole world cracked open and has thankfully never been the same since. I watched Saturday Night Live that night, drugged to the gills. I watched scenes that I had rehearsed hours before. I watched Maya and Keenan sing a song to me, and Seth tap my spot at the update desk and tell me they loved me. I sobbed and sobbed, and then I laughed and laughed. I added a few more years to my life. I kissed Archie's giant head, which was shaped like a beautiful balloon. Today we wear the same size sombrero. He is 6. Well, I'm excited to introduce another guest who's joining me here in my personal audio booth, Seth Meyers.
Hi, Amy.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going great. Thank you for having me in your booth.
Oh, well, it's, you know, I built it many years ago, before I had even written a book.
You can see your handiwork all over it.
Yeah.
Exposed nails, wide open spaces between slats of wood.
Yeah. I didn't really use any blueprints, and I fear the sound isn't going to be very good.
Well, you have an improv construction company that is very unpopular with its customers.
Right. A lot of object work, but no actual wood.
No physical objects.
Yeah. Now, Seth was nice enough a while ago to offer to write something for my book, and then I had to call him and tell him, remember that thing that you said you were going to do? Now you have to do it.
Yeah. But I did say it, and I did do it.
You did do it. You really did do it. And so you're going to read the chapter that you wrote for my book, Yes, Please. And then does this mean that I will have to write a chapter for your book?
Yeah. If I ever write a book, you definitely have to write a chapter
for me. Oh, you, Seth, you gotta write a book.
Oh, I can't. I don't want to because you complained about writing this one so much.
It's terrible.
It's so terrible.
But are you having fun in the studio party with all the people that are here?
It's so great. I just talked to Patrick for about an hour. So lovely.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Is it rude to say that we kind of went into our own conversation while you were reading your chapters?
I did hear you guys chatting while I was reading, but it's just the nice sound of friends.
Your audio guy said he could scrub all that out.
Yeah, he said that with fear in his eyes, because I don't think we're going to be able to do that. But it's okay. I'm glad you're having a good time while I read my book.
It's great. There could be a little more wine.
Okay, sure. I mean, you know, that's always the case, I guess.
Yeah. One bottle for the group.
W-I-N-E, not W-H-I-N-E.
Yeah.
Because that would affect my performance.
Oh, there'll be plenty of W-H-I-N-E in my read. In my nasally reading voice.
Oh, should we let people know that you're reading with a broken nose?
I am reading with a broken nose that I only broke 3 days ago.
Ugh. By the time this audiobook comes out, you'll have your new nose.
I'll have my new
Everyone
nose.
Everyone will buy that story that you broke it playing street
that
hockey.
Story. I went away for a weekend and got a brand new nose.
You know what they say when you get plastic surgery? You should change the color of your hair.
Really? To distract from the nose?
Yep.
You know what I did instead? I got a new talk show set.
Perfect.
I timed it out with a brand new set.
That really is a great way to distract from the work that you've gotten done. You can't see where, because this is audio, but right now Seth is covered in bandages.
I like that you had to tell whoever's listening this is audio. They were wondering why they couldn't see it until you pointed out it was just audio.
You know, it's this kind of bullshit that I need to take from you every day that makes me feel really good that I made you write a chapter for this book. So without further ado, Seth, are you ready to read your chapter?
Yes.
Don't screw it up.
Great.
Okay. And I'm going to step out of the booth and stand on the other side of the glass. And
okay. So I'll wait for you to exit. And then once we lock eyes, I'll start.
Okay. Here I go. Bye, Seth. See you later.
Oh, wait. No, I'd still be full volume. Bye, Amy.
Bye. I'm going to go down the hallway.
Okay, great.
Slam. Door. Room.
Hey, where's she going? Wait a second.
Okay, take it away.
Hello, everyone. My name is Seth Myers, and I will be reading this next chapter that I wrote so that Amy can take a break. It is very hard to write a book. I haven't written one myself, but I know it's very hard because every time I have seen Amy in the past year, she has greeted me by saying hello, quickly followed by, "It is very hard to write a book." At one of these meetups, I offered to write a chapter for her so she could rest. She said yes, please. After I complete this favor for Amy, I will only owe her 1,000 more favors. I am not unique in my great debt to her. Most of Amy's friends owe her around 1,000 favors. She never holds it over you, though. She's not that kind of person. I'm going to tell you about the night that Amy gave birth to her first son, Archie. Before I get there, a bit of background. I first saw Amy Poehler perform in Chicago at a theater called Improv Olympic in the mid-90s. That theater is now called I.O. because the Olympics threatened to sue. The International Olympic Committee was worried people would walk into a 100-seat theater on the corner of Clark and Addison and wonder why no one was jumping over hurdles. The night I first saw Amy, she and the other performers were playing an improv game called The Dream. She asked for a volunteer to come on stage and tell her about their day. I raised my hand and she picked me. My first conversation with Amy was in front of an audience, me in a chair, her standing beside me. She was charming, funny, sweet, and sharp, and I left thinking, I would like to be her friend. The next time I saw Amy perform was with Tina Fey in the same theater. They were workshopping a show called Women of Color. I would later learn that it was the only performance of that show. Amy would move to New York soon after, and Tina would quickly follow. There weren't a lot of people in the audience that night, and for a while, I thought seeing Amy and Tina perform in Chicago right before they left and got famous would be the most interesting thing that ever happened to me. In my mind, it was like seeing the Beatles in Hamburg. And much, I'm sure, like someone who saw the Beatles in Hamburg, I talked about it so much that my friends eventually said, "Genug." At this point, my relationship to Amy was the same as everyone else's. I was a fan. I auditioned for SNL in 2001. My manager called to tell me I'd been hired. He then listed the other new cast members, one of whom was Amy. My first thought after hanging up the phone wasn't, "Oh my God, I'm going to be on SNL." It was, "Oh my God, I might get to be friends with Amy Poehler." I'm happy to say, we were friends right away. I won't bore you with the details of our many years of friendship and collaboration on the show, for no other reason than it is likely Amy has dedicated dozens of pages to that topic in this very book. I wouldn't be surprised if a photo of me graces the cover of this book. To take up any more time talking about it would be redundant. Instead, I will pick up the action years later on a Saturday before the Saturday Amy became a mother. Josh Brolin was hosting the show that week, but this fact would soon be rendered a footnote when Sarah Palin agreed to do a cameo. In 2008, under intense pressure from the comedians' lobby, Senator John McCain selected Alaska Governor Sarah Palin as his running mate. This brought much good fortune to SNL in the form of Tina Fey's mimicry. However, the fact that Governor Palin would actually be appearing on the show was not immediately greeted with cheers. It wasn't that we weren't excited to have her on. We just didn't know what to do with her when she got there. When you perform a sketch about a person when they're not in the room, you have a great deal more freedom than when they are in the room. It was understood that we'd have to write a sketch with Tina and the governor, and we did. It was a soup of moving parts. Alec Baldwin, Lorne, and Mark Wahlberg made cameos. There were some jokes, and it went well. Sensing that the audience might want more, on Friday night, Lorne suggested using Governor Palin a second time on Weekend Update. We sat in our weekly joke read, kicking around ideas that failed to inspire any enthusiasm. For a laugh, someone said the governor could do a rap, perhaps starting with the line, "I'm Sarah Palin, and I'm here to say." Someone else suggested that the governor could get cold feet and Amy could do the rap instead. I don't remember if either of these ideas was meant to be real, but I do remember that Amy's eyes went wide with glee and she left the room with a notebook in her hand. The next time I saw her, she was on the phone with the wardrobe department, barking orders like mission control trying to get a shuttle back. "I need Eskimo suits for Fred and Andy, a snowmobile suit for Jason, and a moose suit for Bobby." Take a second here. Go back and watch the Palin rap one more time. Maybe you forgot how convincing and believable Sarah Palin was when she said she wasn't going to do the piece. Maybe you forgot exactly how pregnant Amy was when she stood up from behind the desk. You probably remember that Amy was good, but you likely forget exactly how good. It's a performance without artifice. She's not play rapping, she's rapping. I still get goosebumps when I think of Amy screaming, "I'm an animal and I'm bigger than you." And the whole time she was doing it, for every single second of it, there was a little person sloshing. That's the correct medical term, yes? Sloshing? Around in her belly. That person, Archie, is getting older every day, and soon he will be aware enough to watch and appreciate what his mother was doing on national television the week before he was born. When I want to smile, I think of that. A week later, on the Friday before the Saturday that Amy became a mother, the entire cast stayed late to block a sketch called the Barack Obama Variety Half Hour. On a normal week, the last piece rehearsed was usually a smaller piece, with a handful of cast members cursing their luck that they had to stay at the studio until 11 p.m. the night before a show. This time, having everyone there together was a luxury and a delight. While we waited for the cameras to set up, Maya and Fred started a bit, pretending they were on stage for the 75th anniversary of SNL. Moving slowly and speaking softly, they delighted us with wooden award show banter wherein they tried to remember the lines to their old sketches. Bill Hader took the stage pretending to be his own son and gave a speech about how much his pops had talked about working on the show before he died. We were all enjoying ourselves that night, but no one more than Amy. She was laughing the hardest, but that wasn't surprising. In my time at SNL, no one was quicker or more gracious with a laugh than Amy. Never more so than at the weekly table read when it was needed most. When a new cast member or writer had a piece bombing to such silence that you could almost hear their pores expelling sweat, you could always count on Amy to give them a laugh. Though to be fair, it was less a laugh and more of a cackle. The writer Alex Bays described it as the sound one hears when running over a raven's foot with a shopping cart. It is, without exaggeration, one of my favorite sounds on earth. We all headed home around midnight in a great mood. A quick but necessary tangent. For years, Amy has called me Coco, and I have called her Moses. These nicknames sprung from a Weekend Update joke about a 6-foot-tall camel named Moses and his tiny pony sidekick Coco, who had escaped from a zoo in Texas. I don't remember the joke, but I do remember that we laughed every time we said a 6-foot-tall camel named Moses and his tiny pony sidekick Coco. At 3 a.m. or so on Saturday morning, Amy texted me, "Water broke, Coco. You're going to do great." And that text is pretty much all you need to know about Amy. Instead of focusing on any of her fear, her excitement, or the anticipation that comes with giving birth for the first time, she sent me words of encouragement. And when I went out to do update without her, I was glad she had. I was nervous and lonely, but I remembered that "you're going to do great" and felt better. Amy is rarely wrong. Doing comedy for a living is, in a lot of ways, like a pony and a camel trying to escape from the zoo. It's a ridiculous endeavor and has a low probability of success, but most importantly, it is way easier if you're with a friend. So that's my chapter. I'm going to shake Amy awake now so she can continue with the hard work of reading her book for us.
Yeah.
I hope she got some rest.
Seth?
Yeah.
Oh, God, I was having this crazy dream that you were saying nice things about me.
Oh.
It was so nice.
I was hoping you were going to run out and buy more wine.
Oh, well, I'm going to get someone to do that for us. I don't buy my own wine anymore. You know
oh,
me.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
Thank you very much, Coco, for reading that.
You're welcome, Moses.
Here's a letter that Hillary Rodham Clinton, then senator from New York, sent to Archie Ardette after he was born. October 25th, 2008. "Dear Archie, happy birthday. I know that your arrival brings great joy to your parents and entire family, and I am pleased to join with them in welcoming you to New York and our nation. Best wishes for a lifetime that includes lasting friendships, boundless curiosity, a love of learning, and a future that is shining and bright. Sincerely yours, Hillary Rodham Clinton," otherwise known as your mother's double.
Figure out what you want, say it out loud, Then shut up.
Birthing plan. To all caregivers, doctors, obstetrical fellows, TMZ interns, and hospital staff, we are looking forward to the birth of our child and ask that the following wishes be respected during our birth process. We have chosen to give birth in a hospital because of the outstanding facilities it makes available to us. We would also like to deliver our baby in a hospital since we spent most of our 20s getting stoned and watching episodes of ER. And so we know that delivering a baby is the best way to cheer up an attractive but beleaguered doctor. Please make sure our doctor is handsome and cares too much. We considered a home birth, but we just got our hardwood floors redone. We also considered a birthing tub, but the mother is concerned the water won't be warm enough. Is it too late to flood the hospital room or turn it into a really fun foam party? We're sorry for asking. The mother is very pregnant and would like to remind everyone her brain has turned into spaghetti. Those we plan to have present at our birth include baby, mother, father, grandparents, lawyers, agents, lottery winners, looky-loos, midwife, first wife, life coach, Fanula the doula, unexpected ghosts, bossy astrologists, and the entire cast of Cheers. All other visitors and unnecessary staff may be turned away unless they're wearing something cute or bring hot wings for the father. The birth environment is very important to us. For that reason, we ask that the lights be kept dim, noise be avoided, and the door be closed for privacy. We would also like people to stay chill and not bring their own shit into the room with them. It's really important that we feel cool. Please decorate the room with Nan Golden prints and leather beanbag chairs. We would love it if you could bring in a silk Persian rug for us to destroy. Think Chateau Marmont if it was closed for repairs. Or, I don't know, MTV Unplugged. Speaking of music, we will arrive with our own. We plan on delivering our baby to the soundtrack of Pink Floyd's The Wall while simultaneously watching The Wizard of Oz. If this kid works with us, we guarantee your minds will be blown. The mother will wear her own clothes to the birth. If the delivery is on a casual Friday, the mother will be wearing a tube top and bike shorts. Regardless of the day, the father will be in a fun tuxedo with jokey suspenders. Both the parents are in entertainment and have no business wear to speak of. Everyone else should be wearing open hospital gowns with nothing underneath. It only seems fair. We plan on handling pain in a variety of natural ways. Please have a birthing ball and back massager available upon request. An annoying nurse with an unfunny and teasing manner on whom we can focus our anger would be a welcome addition. The mother would also like a punching bag, a screaming pillow, a mirror to smash, and a small handgun. The father would like a George Foreman grill, just to have. We ask for vaginal exams only upon request. The mother requires at least a minute or two of chit-chat before cold fingers are introduced. The mother would like to remind the staff that her vagina is the absolute last thing that she wants to have touched right now. The mother can think of 1,000 things that she would rather have presently poked at than her vagina. Honestly, the mother doesn't know how the hell that baby is going to get out of there. And the mother would also like to request that the handsome doctor maintain eye contact at all times during said poking. If induction becomes necessary, we are aware of the non-chemical methods and would like to try them in this order: breast stimulation, sexual intercourse, and cervical cream. That's right, you heard us. If this baby isn't coming out, we're going to start doing it and make you all watch. So let's get cracking. We will use the squatting or semi-squatting position for pushing. Preferably, the mother would like to drop it like it's hot. The mother would like to push at her own pace. The father would like to add that he hopes it doesn't take all day. We would like to feel our son's head as he descends, with the option to stick him back up in there if we don't feel ready. The mother should be given the freedom to walk around during labor. Light choreography is expected. If drugs become necessary, we would like to go all in. We're talking epidural, helium, and roofies. The mother would like to ask one last time why no one is taking seriously her request for nitrous oxide. The mother heard about women in England and Sweden and Canada being offered this at birth, and apparently it works wonderfully to calm nerves and help with delivery. The mother still resents the judgment she received from doctors and friends when she brought up this idea. Either way, if drugs have to be administered, both mother and father know a guy. If delivery assistance is needed, we prefer suction over forceps. If episiotomy is needed, we prefer buttonhole over backstitch. If cesarean is needed, please inform us early so we don't have to go through the above first. In the event of a cesarean, the mother would like to be conscious. The mother would also not mind if you tweaked her abs while you were down there. The father would like to be present and totally freaked out when he accidentally looks past the curtain and sees his wife's organs stacked next to her like laundry. The father would like to be involved in the catching of the baby and the cutting of the cord. At least that's what he's saying right now. We'll see. Please don't cut the cord until it stops pulsing. Please immediately let the cord blood guy in with his titanium suitcase so he can put the cord blood in a vault and keep it fresh. It will help us during the robot apocalypse. After birth, we wish to nurse immediately. Please do not introduce formula or bottles or pacifiers or water unless those things stop this baby from crying. Why won't he stop crying? Wait, where is everybody going? We prefer our stay in the hospital to be extended to the longest period our insurance allows. We need time for our heads to catch up with our bodies. We also need time to catch up on some Judge Judy. Please know we are grateful and sore and happy and scared. We will hear our baby down the hall and recognize his cry, and we will realize this truly is a sci-fi miracle sent to us from G.O.D. That being said, if people buy gifts that aren't on the registry, the mother will lose her shit. The mother would like to take this moment to admit a few things. She thinks natural childbirth is amazing, but she also likes drugs. She didn't put baby oil on her perineum and try to stretch it because she just never felt like it. She lied when she said she completely stayed away from lunch meat. She also skipped Lamaze because sometimes she can't stand being around other people. That's all. We good? Thank you in advance for your support of our choices. We look forward to a wonderful birth. We are excited, but mostly scared. Have you seen the mother? She's tiny. How is this going to work exactly? Please advise. The day I was born. I remember many details about the days my sons came into the world, but very little about my own birthday, partly because I was a newborn baby, and partly because my mother was always a little coy about how the birth went down. When people celebrate birthdays, I like to have them describe the day they were born. Sometimes it's fun to see if the birth matches the personality. Does a big baby turn into a big adult? Does a baby born at home turn into a homebody? Does a baby born on New Year's Eve end up being a real party monster? I was born September 16th, 1971, in Newton, Massachusetts. The most popular song at the time was Joy to the World by Three Dog Night. All in the Family had been on for less than a year, Evel Knievel had just set a world record jumping over 19 cars, and Disney World would open a month later. My mother was 23 years old, and my father was 24, and they had been married for a short 11 months. Mom wore yarn in her hair and claims she doesn't remember a thing about labor. Back then, there was this wonderful thing called twilight sleep, where women were given anesthesia at the onset of labor and woke up with a baby. Today, twilight sleep is when you pass out on your bed while looking at paparazzi photos of Robert Pattinson eating an omelet. I always pictured my mom in a deep sleep, her beautiful, thick hair that I didn't inherit, spread out like a fan on the pillow. The Best of Bread played on the radio while some doctor pulled me out using groovy 70s fondue forks. I figure now would be a good time to ask her how that day went down. Mom, is that how it went down? Did I get it right?
Oh, Amy. It was 1971, the age of almost unnatural childbirth. I had no childbirth education classes, no prenatal diagnostic tests, no ultrasound. I started labor, and Dad took me to the hospital. He went home to await the birth at Nana and Gunka's house. There was no push to include fathers in the delivery room at the time, so that didn't feel strange. I didn't feel afraid. My contraction stalled, so they had to break my water. Things moved fast from then on. I remember the pain, being administered a saddle block anesthetic, and then helpful nurses and my doctor encouraging me at the moment of birth. You were slight in weight, but unusually long, making for an easy delivery. I was thrilled to have a daughter. My mother had modeled so successfully how to bring up daughters. I can still remember that first rush of motherly pride, that assurance that my child was perfect. And then that first twinge of self-doubt. Was I ready for this job? I look like a kid in the pictures, with a long ponytail, smiling, and probably overly confident. Right after you were born, you were happily bottle-fed and then returned to the nursery, and I was given 4 days in the hospital to recuperate. It all seems so separate and sterile now, so different from today's emphasis on instant mother-child bonding. Yet I felt great, and it had all gone so smoothly. Pregnancy had been a different story. I was sick almost every day up to your birth, sometimes on the way to work. I was teaching third grade in a nearby elementary school in 1971, and the policy was that I was supposed to resign my job upon finding out I was pregnant. An understanding principal looked the other way, and I made it through the school year. Over the summer, I gave up my job in preparation for stay-at-home motherhood. There were virtually no other options available. My parents were still young and working full-time. There was no daycare facility nearby. For me, it just wasn't socially acceptable to go back to work full-time, and I had always followed the rules. I was the oldest daughter in my family, the one who was working her 9-to-5 shift at the bra department in our local store, while her sister was at Woodstock. I studied, graduated, got a job, fell in love, got married, and had a baby. I left my job to take care of my daughter. That's the way things were done. That's the way all of my friends were doing it. We moved away to a not-so-neighboring town. Dad went to work every day with the car, and you and I were alone all day in unknown territory. No one knew about postpartum depression then or dared to speak its name. "Snap out of it," was the more common reply. But knowing what I know now, I am quite sure that the signs were there for me. I was often overcome with loneliness, unsure about my choices, missing my friends. Motherhood was a 24-hour-a-day, all-encompassing job. It was the hardest job I had ever had. Everything that happened to you happened to me. I had once heard children described in a novel as hostages to fortune, and certainly my happiness depended on yours. You were not a sleeping baby. You stared at me with those blue eyes at all hours of the day and night. I would walk the length and breadth of our town singing Helen Reddy's You and Me Against the World. It was the time of the burgeoning women's movement, and the National Organization for Women had just been launched, and I was curious and bewildered at the same time. Where did I belong in this new world? Moving to a new suburban town when you were 5 made all the difference. Here lived some college friends and a host of other educated women. Most of them were also at home providing full-time child care. These women and I volunteered, and you came with me. We made paths for a town walking trail, we read to kindergartners, delivered meals to shut-ins, and constructed floats for the 4th of July parade, on which you and your brother sat proudly and waved. We were busy and productive, involved in town politics and issues. It was the beginning of networking for me, a time of making connections and defining goals and career plans. You were always part of all this, watching me become my own person, motivated and ready for change.
Hey, Dad, you want to chime in?
I was thrilled to have a daughter and specifically asked the florist to put a card on the arrangement that read, "Glad it's a girl." I have never forgotten holding you as a newborn, with your whole fanny fitting in the palm of my hand. I figured I would wait for the appropriate time to describe this to you, and now seems like a nice private moment.
That's my birth story. I was small and fussy, and remain so as an adult. 3 years later, my younger brother and only sibling, Greg, was born. I remember my father dressing me to go to the hospital, and my mother commenting on how he put the wrong pants on me. I remember loving my brother instantly. He was my first friend. If your parents are still alive, call them today and ask them to describe the day you were born. Write the details down and tell the story every year on your birthday until you know it by heart. Sorry. I say sorry a lot. When I'm running late, when I'm navigating the streets of New York, when I interrupt someone, I say sorry in one long stream, and the sentence becomes sorry, and it's said really fast, as if even the act of apologizing is something to apologize for. But this doesn't mean I'm a pushover. It doesn't mean I'm afraid of conflict or I don't know how to stand up for myself. I'm getting to a place right in the middle where I feel good about exactly how much I apologize. It takes years as a woman to unlearn what you have been taught to be sorry for. It takes years to find your voice and seize your real estate. I'm still learning the right balance. Sometimes I go too far the other way. I have a quick temper and I'm not afraid to argue. Once, I was flying from New York to Toronto with Tina Fey and Anna Gasteyer on our way to shoot Mean Girls. We were flying in first class and spent the hour-long 10 a.m. flight chatting about life and work. The man sitting next to me was in an expensive suit on his way to what I assume was a meeting, and I got the sense that he hated us and our friendly back and forth. A few times during the flight, he sighed loudly, which I took as a sign that we were bothering him. I ignored it. Maybe that was a mistake, but sighing doesn't really work on me. As we got off the airplane and headed toward the moving walkway, the man pushed past me and jostled me a bit. "Excuse me," I said. "Excuse me? Excuse you," he said. I looked up at his boring, rich guy face. He was turning red, and I realized he was preparing to scold me. He had bumped into me on purpose to teach me a lesson. "You girls were talking the entire flight," he said. "You should not be in first class." All of my lower middle class Boston issues rose to the surface. I don't like it when pratty, privileged old white guys speak to me like I'm their mouthy niece. And I got that amazing feeling you get when you know you're gonna lose it in like the best, most self-righteous way. And I just leaned back and I yelled, "Fuck you!" And then I chased him as he tried to get away from me. And I said, "You rich motherfucker! Who do you think you are? You're not better than me! Fuck you! Fuck you and your fucking opinions, you piece of shit!" And on and on. Tina was laughing, or horrified, I don't remember. I was in a rage haze. Also, I was showing off, which can be, at the very least, embarrassingly transparent, and at the very worst, careless and dangerous. But who doesn't love self-righteous anger? It's great! When I yell at the dads drinking coffee and looking at their phones at the playground while their 7-year-olds play on the preschool monkey bars, I feel like I'm fully alive. But for the most part, I try not to yell, "fuck you." I try to say, "yes, please," and "thank you." "Yes, please," and "thank you," and sorry. But there was one sorry that I took too long to say, and it haunted me for years. Saturdays at SNL were a tornado of activity. I would typically be in 8 or 9 sketches a night, which meant fast costume changes and lots to prepare. Costume changes at Saturday Night Live are a dance all to themselves. Each week, I would confab with my human pit crew and figure out how much time I had to change between my 8 or 9 sketches that Saturday. I would change under bleachers and tucked away in corners, and hearing the sound of the audience while I was in my underwear was thrilling and terrifying. My job was to stay still and obey directions as they shouted, "lift your foot, snap this shut, close your eyes." Bruce would pull off my pre-velcroed shirt as Robert glued on my fake mustache. I would hold up my 2 index fingers next to my head while Jeffrey put on my old man wig, and Spivey would stand next to me telling me that my new cue to enter was, "Thanksgiving is ruined." Everyone was equal during those moments. All of us actors in a play trying to get changed in time. I watched Robert De Niro wiggle into spandex pants as Siegfried, or Roy. I witnessed Donald Trump stepping into a chicken suit. I engaged in small talk with Derek Jeter as he was buttoned into a dress. "How are you doing?" I asked. "Are you nervous?" He just laughed and said, "No." thus settling the long-standing debate about what is more nerve-wracking, live comedy or the World Series. SNL time is completely different from real-world time. Jenna, our stage manager, would peek in and reassure us that we still had a minute 20. Our shoulders would relax, and we would joke around like emergency room doctors. We would chat about someone's boyfriend as we hustled to the stage floor, and more than once, a prop was thrown to me with seconds to go. I would catch it. The crowd would clap. The scene would start. It was chaos. It was so exciting. The problem with busy shows is that details get lost, attention is not equally paid, and things slip through the cracks. It was in one of those cracks that I did the only sketch I regret from SNL. The crack is not an excuse, or maybe it is. This essay is about apologies, and I've learned an important part of apologizing is not making excuses. But that night was particularly busy. It was March 2008, and I was newly and secretly pregnant. I remember feeling tired and worn out. Hillary Clinton was in the cold open, and I stood beside her wearing a matching outfit. It's always extremely weird to play someone as they stand next to you. Coming down from that much adrenaline can drain you. Later that night, I played Dakota Fanning, hosting the Dakota Fanning talk show. Now, I don't do an impression of Dakota Fanning or look anything like her, so the sketch depended on my creepy ability to play a 10-year-old girl with relative ease. It was written by two SNL writers who liked the idea of a highly intellectual Dakota Fanning discussing things that were far too mature for her young age. Her references were often lost on her beleaguered band leader, Reggie, played by the always brilliant Kenan Thompson. Dakota would confess that she was a big fan of Vonnegut, but not familiar with Harry Potter. She loved Tom Waits and enjoyed discussing Japanese poetry. She treated her mom like her manager and claimed she never watched TV. Her upcoming projects were always serious and much too adult. You get the idea. On this particular night, the awesome Ellen Page was the host. Ellen was playing a young and innocent Miley Cyrus. This was in the Hannah Montana days. And Miley slash Ellen was showing Dakota her new doll. The script read like this. Ellen slash Miley. Hey, Dakota, check this out. It's my new Hannah Montana doll. Pretty awesome, right? Ellen takes out a cute doll and makes it dance. Amy slash Dakota. I've also got a new doll. It's from my upcoming film, Hurricane Mary, where my sister and I play severely disabled twins. Amy slash Dakota takes out a creepy doll. Ellen slash Miley. As her doll. Hey, Dakota, wanna play? Amy slash Dakota as her doll. I wish I could, but I'm severely disabled. I rehearsed the sketch and went over the blocking. The entire time, I assumed that Hurricane Mary was something the writers had made up. We did a run-through, and I was told the doll was being made and would be ready by air. The night of the show came, and the doll arrived, and as it was put into my hands, I remember feeling my stomach tighten. It had been manipulated to look like a strange and twisted girl. But there was no time. Jeffrey adjusted my wig. Jenna told me I had 5 seconds. The scene played fine. I ran to the next quick change. Robert glued on a beard. I forgot about my weird feeling, finished the show, went to the after party. Months later, I received a letter from Marianne and Chris Cooper. It was simple and painful. It said something like, "Shame on you for making fun of a real girl. Her name is Anastasia and she's amazing. You should know her story." I knew Chris Cooper from his work in films like American Beauty and Adaptation. I had always heard he was a wonderful person and a delight to work with. I didn't know his wife, Marianne, but a quick Google search told me a few important things. Marianne was an actor and had written the television movie Hurricane Mary, mentioned in our skit. Hurricane Mary was based on the real story of Alba and Anastasia Somoza, twin sisters with cerebral palsy, and their mother's battle to ensure their right to an equal opportunity education as well as their full integration into society. Marianne and Chris had come to know this story through their advocacy for disabled children. The cause was personal for them. Their beloved son, Jesse, had been born with special needs. Well, I'd like to tell you that I responded to the note, or that I turned around and faced the letter head on. I'd even like to tell you that I checked my body and heart and realized I was fine with the sketch and felt no need to apologize. Nope. Instead, I got angry. Anger and embarrassment are often neighbors. Sometimes we get defensive about what we feel guilty about. And I was angry about the fact that I was being accused of something I didn't do. I didn't make fun of a real girl on purpose. I would never do that. That's not me. That's not me at all. I reread the note over and over again. I shared it with other people in the hopes they would agree that Marianne and Chris were overreacting, and I was right to believe I was a good person. I told everyone about it and asked everyone to say it wasn't my fault. I threw the note in the trash like it was evidence of a crime. I stomped around for a bit and then pretended it went away. I was a shitty version of myself, the shadow side. I made a lot of noise because I felt bad about hurting someone's feelings, and I didn't want to get quiet and really figure out how I felt. I was afraid to lie down and put my hand on my heart and hear the tiny voice whispering inside me saying that I had screwed up. Your brain is not your friend when you need to apologize. Your brain and your ego and your intellect all remind you of the facts. I kept telling myself that the only thing I was guilty of was not paying attention. Sure, I was being self-absorbed and insensitive, but who isn't? Sure, I should have been more on top of what I was saying, but wasn't that somebody else's job? Didn't everyone know how busy I was? Didn't Marianne and Chris take into consideration what a nice person I was? My brain shouted these things loud and clear. My heart quietly told a different story. Shame is difficult. It's a weapon and a signal. It can paralyze or motivate. My friend Louis C.K. likes to say that guilt is an intersection. Getting out of it means making a choice and moving forward. I felt guilty and I felt shame, but I didn't really move for years. I parked my car in the intersection and let it sit there until the battery ran out. Then Spike Jones helped me. I bet you didn't expect so many A-list names in my apology story. A word about apologizing. It's hard to do without digging yourself in deeper. It's also scary, and that's why we avoid the pain. We want so badly to plead our case and tell our story. And the bad news is everybody has a story. Everyone has a version of how things went down and how they participated. It's hard to untangle facts and feelings. For me, as a person in comedy, I'm constantly weighing what I feel comfortable saying. There are big differences between what you say on live television and what you say at dinner, but you realize you have to be responsible for all of it. Each performer has to figure out what feels right. I'm a strong believer in free speech, and I've spent most of my adult life in writers' rooms. I have a high tolerance for touchy subject matter. There isn't a taboo topic I can think of that I haven't joked about or laughed at. But I have an inner barometer that has helped me get better at pinpointing what works for me and what feels too mean or too lazy. I like picking fair targets. I don't like calling babies on websites ugly or comedy that relies on humiliation. I love ensembles, and I hate when someone bails or sells their partner out. I love watching a good roast, but I don't think I would be particularly good at roasting someone. Maybe it all comes down to what you feel you're good at. I have a dirty mouth, but know that I don't always score when I work really blue. I have a sense of what kind of jokes I can get away with and still feel like my side of the street is clean. I like to lean my shoulder against limits and not depend on stuff that is shocking. That being said, I still made a joke about someone being disabled. I didn't know it was a real person, but why does that matter? All of this left me stuck in that guilt intersection. I knew I was wrong, but couldn't move. I lived in fear of running into Chris and Marianne, which was strange because there really wasn't anyone else in the world I was afraid to be in a room with. This made famous person stuff stressful because Chris was famous and an actor, and there was a high chance I would run into him at an award show. I don't want to backdoor brag as I make my way to the end of this apology tale, so let me just front door brag and talk about the cool people I get to be friends with. I am friends with Kathleen Hanna and Adam Horowitz, a.k.a. Ad-Rock from the Beastie Boys. I can't believe I'm friends with them. I love Kathleen's music, and I am in awe of her social activism and general awesomeness. You know, I asked her to interview me for Interview Magazine when I was just a sketch performer whom nobody knew. She said yes, Because she supports young women, this is the artist who pulled women to the front at her rock shows. She shows up and does the work and is the real deal. Now she's my friend. And her husband, Adam, is also my friend. I used to listen to the Beastie Boys on my Walkman and dream about meeting them, and now I have Adam's email. I'm blowing my cool cover here, but I'm so psyched that we're friends. I am also friends with Spike Jones. Guess who else I'm friends with? Kim Gordon, Norman Lear, Martin Short. It's awesome. I can't lie. It's just so awesome. See how I'm trying to distract you from the shitty thing I did? Anyway, I was at dinner with some of these people, and Spike mentioned working with Chris. I told him my story and how 5 years had passed, and I was still sitting on this feeling that I had blown it. Spike gently reminded me that it's never too late to reach out and apologize. Spike told me he was looking at some similar themes in his new movie, Her. What I didn't know then was how a year later I would watch that beautiful movie about love and loss with my wonderful new boyfriend, Nick Kroll. I would watch the scene where Joaquin Phoenix reads an apology letter he writes to his ex-wife, and I would cry for all the things behind me and all the things yet ahead. Spike offered to connect me to Marianne, and I gratefully agreed. Then he sent me this. From Spike Jones, March 11th, 2013, to Amy Poehler. Subject, forward, hey, for Marianne and Chris. I didn't realize the whole situation. I leave it in your hands. I'm sorry, Amy. Being a grown-up is hard. Marianne is an awesome woman. I'm sure you guys would get along great if you met in a different situation. Big hugs. X. On March 11th, 2013, Marianne wrote, yeah, I was furious at the skit she did on SNL and wrote a letter to tell her. The skit was a gratuitously cruel slap at disability, which wasn't funny in the least. What made it so, so horrible was that she was talking about the Somoza twins and the script I wrote about their lives. It was also the same night Hillary Clinton was on, and I knew that Anastasia was watching it with friends, since she was in Texas stumping for Hillary. So I knew she saw herself being parodied in a horrible, unfunny, cruel way. I was doubly insulted for the twins that Poehler never had the class to answer the letter, so quite frankly, I am glad that it bothered her. We had our return address on the letter, and face it, we're not that hard to find. So, Spike, what I feel now is that we don't need an apology from her, but if she wants to make it up to Anastasia, she can contribute to her staying at London School of Economics for another year to get her master's in human rights. Nothing will stop Anastasia. She will affect change in the world. Love always, Marianne. I read Marianne's email and was devastated. I pictured Anastasia watching the show and seeing me make fun of her. I waited a month and sent this. Dear Marianne and Chris, I'm writing to apologize. This is most likely an example of too little too late, but I'm writing to you to apologize for a Dakota Fanning sketch I did on SNL many years ago. It was a sketch that upset you and Anastasia, and one that moved you to write to me. It's always bothered me that I never contacted you both. I regret that. I spoke of this to Spike, and he very nicely connected us. I'm grateful to him for giving me this opportunity, and I appreciate you taking the time to read this. I'm very sorry for any pain I caused. I apologize for an insensitive portrayal of what was a loving and important project. I'm truly sorry for hurting Anastasia in any way. I don't think it's funny to make light of disabilities. It's not the kind of person I am or have ever been. The sketch was not written by me. The mean prop used was not seen by me until live on air. In fact, I had no idea that we were referencing a real film. I assumed it was yet another adult project that we would joke about Dakota Fanning working on. These are not excuses. I take responsibility for my negligence and understanding the context of what I was saying, but it's important for me to tell you these details. Anastasia deserves an apology from me. Feel free to pass this along if you feel that is helpful, or send me her email if you deem it appropriate. I visited her Indiegogo page. She is an awesome young woman, and I have no doubt she will continue to live an amazing life. Again, I am sorry. I send my best wishes to you and your family, and my deepest condolences regarding the loss of your son. Thank you for reading this, Amy. Rereading it now, I notice a few things. I got a little caught up in the facts. I was hoping to defend myself, but it felt really good to try. Apologies have nothing to do with you. They are balloons in the sky. They may never land. They may even choke a bird. Then I got this. From Anastasia Somoza, March 11th, 2013, to Amy Poehler, subject, apology accepted. Dear Amy, wow, oh my goodness, what a lovely surprise. Thank you very much for your donation to my campaign launch to raise funds that will hopefully cover the cost of my caretakers in my second year at LSE, and for the kind message you wrote to Marianne and Chris, which they graciously forwarded.